Garden River.
Out in Yuma.
In Training Day.
Just north of there on Yuma.
So, as you can see from looking at the chart here, by far the largest volumes are coming out of the Kenai Field and the Beluga Field. The state's effective shares are shown there, both our effective rate as well as the royalty volumes. We have discussed this, the status of this lawsuit, or these lawsuits, with the committee July 17th. And at that time, we were considering an underlift-overlift arrangement as a possible approach to settlement of the litigation. At a subsequent meeting, two of the producers involved in the Beluga Field indicated that in order for an underlift to be satisfactory from their point of view, they would want to be reimbursed for the difference for that 1/8. And that they were hoping that Chugach would reimburse them this money in the future. In other words, the difference between what the gas was ultimately sold for and the 21-cent value. Following that session, the division reviewed the position of all the parties and determined that underlift probably would not be a workable solution to settling the litigation, given the position of those two producers, which were ARCO and Shell. At that time, we began pursuing an alternate plan, and that is to look at the possibility of in-kind sales. There are two basic possibilities that we're looking at this point, and we are involved in discussions now with Chugach Electric, with NSTAR, as well as with the producers. But specifically, what we are looking at is whether we could arrange to make direct sales of our in-kind share to Chugach and to NSTAR in lieu of the present arrangement, which leaves that gas in value. There are two possibilities, really. One would be...
This question would go on. Sure. Okay, Matt. If you do that, what you were just saying, what effect will it have on the price?
Well, I'm going to get to the discussion of the price, but it's, I guess the short answer is it's uncertain and it's negotiable, I mean, the price. But I'm going to be discussing that in just a moment. The first scenario in your mind would be that we would make a sale from the Beluga Field to Chugach and from the Kenai Field to NSTAR. The second possibility would be to make...
Okay, I'm trying to follow that. Could you say that again, Bill?
Yes. Would be a sale of our royalty volume to Chugach out of the Beluga Field and to NSTAR out of the Kenai Field.
And currently, that gas is being passed on... Oh, I guess get through this one. So I clearly try to understand, follow you through on this scenario. That current gas is being passed on to the producers, which is the gas contract. It's the same identical gas contract which you're reevaluating the price on.
Well, it's really not the same contracts. We don't have gas sale contracts presently. We take our gas under the terms of our leases with the producers. It's now left in value. The producers have made long-term sales arrangements with those entities, and so...
So what you're doing an in-round on the producers, though.
Well,
I mean, if producers are sitting there right now, I am trying to figure this out. Producers, let's take our favorite over here, Barber's outfit. What's that, Union? Let's take Union. And Union's got the gas, and they're doing something with it, and part of that's selling it back over, I guess, to NSTAR and Chugach. We take them out of the picture because you're no longer, you're going to take it in actual and hand them a contract to NSTAR and to Chugach. They're going to buy it from you instead of buying it from Union, right? And would you, but only a portion of it, probably not all of it. Well, that's kind of a nice trick. I like that. That doesn't sound too bad. Then the real trick comes down to is what price you negotiate with NSTAR and Chugach for that gas, right?
Right.
And whether or not the transportation could be worked out. Because transportation has always been the key regarding you guys taking it in Beluga or in Kenai.
That's right. You're right on the track there. If we do the first possibility that I described, the transportation would not be such a significant issue because, of course, Chugach has their facility right there at the Beluga and we wouldn't be needing to move the gas anywhere. However, the second possibility would be a cross-sale, in other words, a sale to Instar out of Beluga and a sale to Chugach out of Kenai. There are some reasons that we want to pursue that alternative.
I just tell him it sounds a good deal. Keep going.
Okay. One consideration that we've looked at is that the Chugach contract with the Beluga producers does have what's called a most favored nations provision. And it essentially says that if Chugach buys it from someone else at a greater price than they're paying the producers, then the producers are entitled to that greater price, which of course makes Chugach not very interested in negotiating any prices higher than what they're presently paying and putting at risk their 7/8. By doing the cross sale, we avoid that problem. However, with the cross sale, we would be looking at having to transport the gas from the Kenai unit probably to the Bernice Lake station where Chugach does have facilities now for generating electricity. So we are looking at both of those possibilities and talking with the utilities about that, and it's still early to say whether we'll be able to come to an agreement that's acceptable to everyone on that. Of course, as Representative Szymanski said, the major issue is what is the price. As far as the transportation charges, Instar has indicated that they are willing to move the state's gas at a reasonable price, and we have yet to come to terms on what that would be. We're also looking at what Instar's obligations are as a public regulated utility. Whatever arrangements were to be made for in-kind sales would require the cooperation and accommodation of the producers. Specifically, we would like to take a portion of our stream in kind and leave some of it in value. Generally, we're looking to leave the high prices in value and take the low prices in kind. Secondly, the deliverability issue. Of course, at least the Beluga field kind of goes up and down with the peak demand in the winter, so our royalty share would be greater in the winter, but it's a question of are we taking it on a daily basis, a monthly basis, a yearly average, or what, and that is another issue that we would hope to negotiate an acceptable arrangement with the producers on that. So over the next month, I would say we hope to conclude the discussions on this and be able to determine whether we'd be able to propose in-kind contracts that would avoid the disagreement over the interpretation of the lease form with what in value means. The producers have said to us on more than one occasion, if you don't like the price that we're getting, take it, market it yourselves, and see if you can get a better price for it. The policies that we're guided by in trying to settle this are we're attempting to find or make sales at market value, as we believe the statute requires. However, there are some things in here that make it difficult to come to the market value, the long-term, the issue of the long-term contracts, the litigation going on, and some of those other things, which do seem to be somewhat of a drag on the value. Secondly, the broad policy question, should the state be subsidizing our utility ratepayers or consumers directly through the royalties? We continue to think it's preferable to sell our royalty resources at market value and to find other ways for subsidizing consumers if that is desired, and in line with the legislative sentiment expressed in H.R. 9, the division is continuing to look at what those other mechanisms for subsidy might be. We hope to have a report on that for you no later than January when you debate again. Another part of this whole issue, of course, is what's going on in the federal arena, and I thought Mark...
You're going to report back to us by January on recommendations specifically addressing the subsidy question?
well, HR 9 asked that we investigate ways for restoring the benefits eliminated by enforcement of the leases, and we are attempting to come up, to comply with that request. So it's my hope that we'll have some recommendations or at least some options better defined for you at that time.
And my only comment is going to be that I do hope you have it available to us before.
Excuse me, this is the Juno moderator. We're unable to hear anything.
Good thing you spoke up, otherwise I wouldn't hit the switch. Samansky again. I hope that you come back with that report by January, because I think we're going to be embroiled in a real battle in the legislature during this next session associated with power cost subsidies. And rural Alaska is going to be in there. I mean, you're not hearing from them here today, but I mean, they're going to be in there slugging away to maintain their power cost assistance program. And what's good for the folks in Anchorage is going to be good for the folks in rural Alaska is going to be the scream. And my inclination is that you better have a better story to tell other than we're better looking or something. I don't know what the story would be, but I mean, we're prettier people or something. I don't see it, but that's the argument. You get into all kinds of absurd arguments back and forth on power cost assistance, but the folks that represent rural Alaska are saying we want our piece of the action, same as the people in Anchorage and South Central Alaska, and I'm quite frankly concerned that we don't try to come in with some absurd basis for justifying a subsidy without recognizing we have to deal with the whole state. So I'm looking forward to seeing your report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't break out in sweat now.
Okay, Mark is going to speak briefly about the status of the federal litigation.
As the committee may or may not know, in May of 1984, the Minerals Management Service issued, the Department of Interior on a counterclaim in a pre-existing lawsuit in federal court, issued a retroactive order to Union Oil Company of California seeking gas royalties back to 1977. That order was revised in May of this year and was going to be resolved judicially pursuant to an expedited briefing schedule this month by Judge Fitzgerald. Last summer, Union went into court and announced that it had its administrative appeal process completed before the judicial results, before it became determined by the court as far as the legality of the order. And so right now, the parties and a number of amicus curiae have filed briefs with the Department of Interior concerning that issue. Basically, there's about $100 million in retroactive royalties at stake. The Department of Interior has not indicated how it will proceed with that. Right now, there is no payment of that $100 million, but there's a bond to protect the royalty owners against the possibility to protect them on that amount. That bond runs out at the end of this month, and so one of the big issues right now is what to do about that bonding requirement, whether or not you need to be required to make the $100 million payment right away, or whether that bond will be continued pending final judicial determination of this matter. Last Friday, the state filed a brief with the Department of Interior urging that the order be enforced, upheld by the department, and be made right for final judicial action immediately. And conditioned upon an expedited briefing schedule in court, the state indicated it would, it urged Interior and said it would agree to having a bond continue in effect rather than requiring immediate payment.
Who said that the, and I didn't catch it, who said that the bond would stay into effect? That
well, this Interior has not taken any position on this formally. The state's brief, it urged Interior to take it as its own position, and we stated that we would support that conditional relief, as we called it, that the bond be continued pending final judicial action. But we didn't want to have the issue buried forever in administrative proceedings, IBLA proceedings. So we took the position that that would know, we already have a whole bunch of money at stake, $100 million, and if the matter languishes in IBLA for another couple of years with interest, it will grow to an even more unmanageable sum. So we believe it's everyone is better served by having the judiciary decide this issue, because it's clear that the judiciary will be making the cut one way or the other down the line, and so we supported a prompt resolution rather than a delayed one.
Yes, Mark. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, you've done a good job giving us a rundown on the process that this case has gone through. Can you back up for a moment and explain to me who the parties in the case are and what the issues, what are we saying and what are the parties saying to each other?
Certainly, I should have started with that. You have before you a chart showing the production from the union field, among others, and what's at issue here is the Kenai unit and union share. And so specifically what's at issue and primarily is the Union Chemical 40%, 41% of production from the Kenai field is by far the lion's share. It's 80% or 82% of what's at dispute in that case has to do with Union's commercial use of gas. It is asserting in the federal court that the value of that gas for royalty purposes is the internal transfer price between divisions of Union, the production division, and the urea ammonia manufacturing division for that gas. The Department of the Interior is asserting that the value of that gas is the current market value of the gas at the time of production, which they have a particular formula, which is not different from the state's, but they have a formula basis which ranks different contracts of existing dispositions from the Cook Inlet area and comes up with the value of that portion of the gas which is moved under the contract which covers the 50 to 51st percentile of the gas. And they're saying that is the current market value and that value should apply instead of the internal transfer price. It also affects, and this probably makes it more politically interesting, the APL Volumes, which is Alaska Pipeline Company, better known as NSTAR, and that you can see is about 10% of Union's of the production from the field. And it's my understanding that order also covers Marathon's flow of gas under APL 1, so it would cover that 14%.
Where's that 10% on the turnip?
Yeah, APL Anchorage for Union is 10.28%. And under Marathon, 14.38. One of the issues is whether or not the order, which was directed only to Union, could also include Marathon's volumes under that contract. It apparently purports to do so. So that gas is also at issue. And again, it's whether or not that reasonable minimum value, which is the federal lease form and regulation, which states that, you know, that the Secretary of the Interior has the power to establish a, quote, reasonable minimum value, unquote, for royalty purposes of gas or oil produced. And the question is whether or not the contract price should control or whether the Secretary's determination of what reasonable minimum value is should control.
When you talk about a contract price in the case, the federal case.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm unable to hear you.
So when you refer to a contract price, is this contract price a fixed price contract, or is it some kind of index price that is sold at?
Well, the company position is that in both the state litigation and the federal litigation, that the contract price, as established by that contract, forever will remain the royalty value as well as the contract price. So some of the contracts do have escalation factors in them, the so-called APL-2 contract, which both the federal government and the state, in our dispute, assert establishes the proper royalty value. It is currently $2.05 per MCF, but 2 years ago it was $2.32, and it gets adjusted every year under the terms of the contract.
What he's asking, what causes that adjustment?
That one is adjusted according to a fuel oil price with Tesoro.
So it's indexed to Tesoro's fuel?
Yes, it's indexed according to an oil price.
Just to dig a little bit into this formula that we you're talking about the Department of Interior, whoever it is, adjusting the, what the value of the royalty have. If that price were not indexed to a Tesoro fuel price, but rather just said it was, you know, $1.50 forever or whatever the contract said, would that formula you're referring to also tend to yield a fixed value for the royalty, or would that one float up and down regardless of what the contract said for the remainder?
The federal methodology would depend upon changes in the prices under which gas was moved and the array of prices. So it would be subject to change depending upon future sales and what the interplay between all the contracts in the area would yield. So the position is that both the federal government and the state, this is a common ground, that it's the value at the time of production which is the key, rather than the value at the time the contract was entered into under which gas was sold. And so as gas was moved under a different complexion of contracts under the royalty, the federal system, that they would look at the array of contracts which were in effect on a given month and come up with a result.
One last question. I have some others, but I'll hold until you're done. When you refer to the array of prices, is it more or less what you might call a weighted average of all those prices, or is it the highest price that anything is going for that is the determining price for this adjustment?
Well, I would say it's not an adjustment, it's a valuation. But in any event, under the federal system, it's not a weighted average. It's an attempt to come up with the quote median unquote value, which would be the value under which the 50 to 51st percentile of the volume of gas from the Cook Inlet region for that month moved.
Okay, I have some other questions, but I'll wait to get you. Thank you.
Let me ask you.
You say the weighted average of the volume of gas moved, that would be that the majority of the gas is then being sold at a long term contract of 22 cents, and weighted average would tend to be, if the vast volume is at 22 cents, then the weighted average should be pretty low. Is that correct?
Well, we are not using, they are not using weighted average, they're using median value.
Median value.
Right. Their methodology is a little more complex. I can give you the order, but it excludes certain volumes for certain reasons, and it attributes a 2055 price to the LNG volumes. And so that the methodology is meant to arrive at the median value, and one of the issues on appeal and for the court to decide is whether or not they did that appropriately, even if they're entitled to assert their value issue at all. But rather than, it's not my methodology, rather than try to describe it, that's the goal of the methodology. That does make adjustments. It's not just a pure look at all the sales out there.
Go ahead.
What is the median price of all these things that are on the chart?
Well, the one that in the federal order currently would be the APL-2 contract.
Which is
$2.05 per MCF.
Okay,
thank you. Any further questions?
Mark, can you just tell me, what is the state trying to do in this litigation? What's the objective that the state's trying to achieve?
Well, the state did not initiate the litigation. We were sued by the oil companies. What we tried to do in our notice the division's notice last March, was to obtain to enforce the way we interpreted the leases, which is that the state's entitled to the fair market value of the gas at the time of production, rather than merely 1/8 of the proceeds of the gas as produced under the contract.
Why is the state trying to do that? Maybe that's enough for a question for you. Maybe that's a good question.
Perhaps it is. But I can give the answer that I think that's what they, my understanding, we went through this last April, we believe we have an obligation to enforce the contract for the benefit of all the people of the state.
What? Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, well, what that's what I'm trying to get to is, what is this perceived best interest that the people of the state of Alaska have, most especially those people in the Anchorage area that live off that gas? What benefit are we going to get from this new interpretation of the contract? Now you're saying that all the people that served in the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Oil and Gas prior to last March when it started were somehow remiss and weren't performing their duty because they interpreted the contract in a different way?
I don't care to comment on that. That seems to me a rhetorical question. I'm not going to speculate about people in the past or why they did things or didn't do things.
I think the first half of your question.
Well, I'm a lawyer, and my role was to give advice about what I thought the lease form required. And I think that as far as the policy and whether or not to enforce leases and contracts was one that was made by the division. And if you may recall, there was a decision memorandum that was issued November of 84, which weighed a number of the factors concerning, including the one that you were raising with me right now, and went through a reasoned analysis about why the state elected to do what it did. And I don't believe any of that has changed. And I'd be happy to give you a copy of that memorandum that was signed off by the administration.
Yeah, well, I do have that memorandum, but I really would like you to refresh my memory and restate what it is that the state is going to gain by this. What are we doing here that's in the public interest?
Well, as I say, I'm a lawyer, and I was sued, and so I'm defending, the state was sued, and so it's my responsibility to defend. And as far as my role in the past, it was stated in that memorandum, and it's really not appropriate for me, I think, to debate policy questions with you. And so I will decline your invitation to debate those issues.
May I address the question to the director?
I think Kay's getting ready to speak. Kay, you're on stage now.
Thank you. I think we believe that it is in the best interest of the people of Alaska to have our leases enforced with the oil companies and to get for the people the money that we're owed under the leases. That's pretty simply what we're trying to accomplish. As you'll recall, and as we went through with the legislators last spring when this first arose, the statute speaks to what we are to obtain under the leases. It says we're to get not less than 12.5% in amount or value. And of course, that is really what the dispute goes to, is what is the value and what does that term mean? Does that mean value, current value, and how is value established? The following on the discussion that the committee was having this morning and Representative Rieger's point about could that, the definitions being discussed provide to address the value. If I was reading the context correctly, the definitions are going to be in-kind sale and what would be the value to be attained in an in-kind sale as opposed to leaving the resource in value with the producers for marketing by the producers. So I think that is a question that we're struggling with now, is if we were to make an in-kind sale, what should the value be? What is the value? We feel that leaving it in value, we're making a lease form interpretation, and that we are entitled to receive the price received by others, and that that's under that provision of the lease form that speaks to what value shall not be less than. And that's why we have asserted that $205 is the appropriate price left in value. And then, of course, it is an open issue as to what price we hope to obtain in an in-kind sale, and trying to find something that is acceptable to Chugach and to Instar, and that would still be a fair value for the sale of those resources, which do belong to all the people.
I'd like to caution the debate, I guess, that we see differently on this issue, but we do have a taped off. That's one thing we have right now. And can you take care of it? I don't know how to take care of that machine.
Hey, Brandon, we're going to hurry.
I don't need to take a break, but I'd like to not have a, you know, a full debate on this thing, on this issue. We're taking a short break until we get back on tape. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that we've got something coming up at 2:00, and I would like to have some time for public comment on the royalty contracts. But I'm not trying to cut you off. I'm just trying to give you some.
I'm not attempting to debate. What I'm trying to get is the administration's philosophy with this policy, because we don't know whether we're going to go along with it unless we really understand what the philosophy of the policy is.
What's your position? Should we or should we not subsidize the gas prices in Anchorage?
I'm not the one that signs the orders.
Well, you're a policy maker. What's your position?
After I get all the information, I'll tell you what my policy is.
I think that's the bottom line, Mark. I mean, either we bite the bullet and we're either going to get into subsidizing or we're not going to subsidize. And, you know, can't have your cake and eat it, too.
I don't think that's the whole issue.
Subsidizing.
You're talking about contract prices. I don't see any subsidy there.
No, but I mean, if you want to argue the legal side of it, then you get into the legal argument where they're at.
Jonathan, are we on tape yet?
Yes, we are.
We'll reconvene and we'll let this go on the record. Anyway, I'm sure, let's not try to solve the problem. If you have some questions that need to be addressed, please go ahead. But this debate won't be finished today, or at least resolution of it.
Well, to reiterate, I'm trying to get to the fundamentals of the administration's position for taking the action last March that led to this situation. And it seems to me that, you know, we mentioned $100 million in differences that the state may be owed under the new interpretation of the leases.
The $100 million figure represents the amount that's due under federal order to union. I don't believe we've ever used the $100 million figure for any of our...
We're in a lawsuit. All right, so you have some dollar amount that the state is going to receive in the treasury. I remember $7 million from last April. Okay, now I'm back into it. That the state would receive in the treasury from the increased price of the gas. Okay, where is that $7 million going to come from? And if it comes from NSTAR and Chugach, or if it comes from Marathon and Union, we all know that the consumer here in Anchorage is going to end up paying for that.
No.
I think if you look at the Kenai field, you'll find that 40% of that production is the urea plant for Union, which would have no pass-through to anyone. And the rental gas here, which combination comes up to be about 15% of Kenai production, again, has no pass-through. So the only part that has a pass-through is the APL-1, which is 14% of Kenai field, is already being moved at $2.05, so even under the contract price, $4.48, I read that wrong here. So what we're talking about, the only place where there's a pass-through, and this is one of the problems about having a uniform lease enforcement, is that it's a little hard to pick and choose, that if we decide to, the administration decides to try to enforce it only against industrial users and so forth, they may claim that it would be inappropriate to give us a break on the where there's a pass-through to the consumer, have a different lease enforcement action because of the effects on the consumer than we have when the effect falls somewhere else. And as far as the integrity of the process, it's something that is thrown up against the state. In the Marathon LNG litigation, that was one of their counts, that we could not enforce a higher valuation of the gas that was sold as LNG in Japan because we had done something differently with Union. And we have all our leases in the North Slope that are the same form for oil and gas, and we think as one of the policies is that we do not want to jeopardize the integrity of our lease enforcement generally because this very small tail of the lease enforcement action, the part that impacts the Anchorage consumer, has that impact.
Well, just one final urging, I guess, is that when we're making a state policy on this issue, it seems to me we ought not to be guided primarily by what the internal transfer price is between Union Gas and Union Chemical, but we ought to be guided by the effect the policy is going to have on the people in South Central Alaska that rely on gas as their primary fuel. Even if that is less than 50% of the total use of the field, that's the most important part because it hits all of us right where we live here. that's what ought to guide the policy, and I think that's why we have a difference between what the commissioner did last March and what we're urging now.
I was just going to ask, does that mean that if we were to propose a in-kind contract at a price lower than we've maintained to this point as value, that you would support that approach?
I may. I'm not one who believes that the only way that the Alaska public derives benefit from royalty oil and gas is through dollars in the state treasury. I think the best way we can derive benefit from our oil and gas is through lower consumer prices. And if selling the gas on a royalty basis at a lower price will mean that we can get that savings passed on to the consumer, I think we'll all be happier here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I realize you've got some point that you want to make, that it's succinct and everything, but I think Steve was actually heading in. It's my apology to Steve. Even though you're not a member of the committee, you're certainly willing to participate fully and go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't debate, but I just have a couple of questions that have been bothering me, and I asked the question this morning, and I'm sure that it's been answered totally. And it has to do with this question of market value, and this is really a policy question, and more to the director, if I can. The statutes and the drafts we're talking about refer to market value. And I guess my question is, in a long-term contract, is market value considered to be market value for the duration of that contract, if it was arrived at on, you know, an arm's length basis?
Although you directed that to Gabe Brown, that does have to do with the issues in the litigation, and the response is that the case authorities, which we find persuasive, indicate that for the royalty context, the contract price does not establish value for the duration of the contract under which the gas is sold by the producer. If it's in value, if we take our gas in kind, we would be doing something else than having our in value royalty obligation. We could sell it for whatever we want, which is higher or lower, which does not have to be market value.
And as to whether it would fluctuate, that would be governed by the terms of that sale. If there were an in-kind sale, whether it would be at a fixed price or a price that was readjusted in the future on the basis of something else like oil prices, or if it were to just be renegotiated periodically, that would be governed by the terms of the contract.
Okay, well, I think I understand your answer. I'm not sure I agree with him, but I know at least where you're coming down and how you're drawing the line between in value and in kind. And I'll hash that out some more with the time we're done. The other question I have, and it goes back to this median price that you referred to, and I'm going from memory, but my memory is that when we held some hearings on this back in Juneau, there was a key phrase which was prevailing price, if I remember right. Language. And I guess my question is, when I look at this chart and the quantities of gas which are sold at the different prices, I see 126,000 out of the total of maybe 300,000 or 400,000 at 21 cents, and a lot more gas sold below a dollar. What is the prevailing price in this? And I find it hard to even see how someone could say that the median is 205 if you're counting the numbers of MCF each one. Maybe you could explain again what the state's position is, the administration's position on prevailing price in the context of leasing.
Well, it is simply that the only prevailing values that count under our analysis of the lease form are the ones which have to do with for production now. And if you have a contract from 1975, that it may have some relevance to the prevailing value of the gas at the time in 1975, but it doesn't have much to say about the prevailing value now. And so it is our view that you have to look at the most current transactions, which would be the best evidence of what the value is.